Hi, we're about to start. Welcome. I'm Catherine Rowe. I'm Oxford Research Group's new CEO. I've actually only been in the job a week, a whole week. So I'm glad to say that you won't be hearing from me again this evening, but you will be hearing from my very, very knowledgeable colleagues. You know, what I lack as yet in knowledge about our work, I make up for in great enthusiasm. Enthusiasm for our mission, which is to promote more inclusive, accountable, sustainable, and effective approaches to breaking out of cycles of conflict and violence. Enthusiasm for the really exciting and groundbreaking work that we've been developing, whether that's in Yemen or here in the UK or elsewhere. And enthusiasm for our ability to speak to and for a really diverse range of voices and to enable groups with very different perspectives and interests to hear each other. This evening, we're launching the latest report from our remote warfare program, Fusion Doctrine in 5 Steps, Lessons Learned from Remote Warfare in Africa. We're enormously proud of the way this program has developed, and that our research and our engagement provide practical, policy-relevant ways to help ensure that the kind of interventions we term remote warfare protect civilians, are subject to appropriate levels of scrutiny, and have outcomes in clear support of a lasting political settlement. It's wonderful to see so many of you here this evening to discuss our report. Thank you very much for coming. I hope you'll stay on after the discussion to meet new and familiar others in the room. And I'd also like, on behalf of ORG, to very much thank our very expert panel for joining us, and that we're really looking forward to hearing your different perspectives. So now let me hand over to the chair of our panel, Mary Harper. Mary's Africa editor of the BBC World Service and also writes for other media and for academic publications, and she's written 2 books. So please welcome Mary and the rest of our panel.
Thank you very much, and welcome everybody to the launch of this fascinating and quite challenging report. I hope you can all hear me. And before you we start, I'd just like to tell you that the first part of the discussion, when the panelists make their contributions, is going to be on the record, and it's going to be recorded. And you're very welcome, encouraged, in fact, to tweet about it using the hashtag 5 Steps to Fusion. But the question and answer session will be off the record, so that bit is not really to be tweeted about, and so people will feel more free to speak when they know that they're not speaking on the record. And before I hand over to the panellists, I just wanted to say a little bit. I'm a bit confused about what fusion doctrine is, but I'm sure I'll learn more during the evening. But it seems to be the latest attempt to build a more coherent British foreign policy, and that it's the latest iteration of a number of initiatives which may be started with Tony Blair's joined up government policy. And what this report makes quite clear is that even though there have been some improvements, massive challenges remain. And the example that they've chosen to look at closely is the issue of remote warfare in Africa. And this has obviously become something of a trend in recent years, where instead of deploying large numbers of your own troops to countries, places like the United Kingdom and other Western and other countries support countries, local and regional forces on the front line. And there's lots and lots of examples of this happening across Africa. And as a journalist working on the region, that's a very big part of my job, is trying to untangle all these very complicated military engagements, in particularly in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel. And in fact, even this morning, like the World lead news on the BBC was about two French helicopters colliding and France suffering its biggest loss of troops in decades, and they were in Mali. So that's just a sort of example of the kind of thing that happens. And I would say the place where I've had the most kind of shocking experience of this multiple interventions and confused policies is in Somalia, where I've spent the last kind of 25 years reporting from very, very closely. And I never know when I'm there who I'm going to be next going to bump into in terms of military people who are advising or remotely involved. The Turks, the Qataris, the UAE, all setting up military, or have set up military bases there. Obviously the US has drones, the African Union has thousands of forces on the ground. Ethiopia is partly in the African Union, but also has its own other forces there. The EU, UK, on one of my recent trips, I spent hours in a town called Baidoa with British troops who were there training the police. Well, they thought they were training the police. I'm not so quite so sure whether they were really police. But anyway, that just Somalia sees an example, seems an example of where this whole issue of how you get involved militarily, remotely or not, has not really led to huge improvements on the ground, let's say. That's been going on for pretty much 30 years now, and Somalis themselves seem somewhat, in fact, extremely baffled and confused about what on earth all these foreign powers are trying to do as they watch their country continue to be in a state of conflict with very little sign of improvement in sight. But the people who know really about this are the people sitting here on this panel, and I'll just very briefly introduce you before you make your contributions. We have Abigail Watson, who's a research manager at the Oxford Research Group's Remote Warfare Programme, and she's a co-author of this report. She's co-authored a number of other reports on this subject, and her work has been published in several places, including Just Security, Open Democracy, and you can also find it on the WarPod podcast. And then here sitting on my right is Andrew Chi, who's a research fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies here in London. He's editor of their armed conflict database, which focuses on monitoring armed conflict trends globally. And his research focuses on Africa, including peacekeeping, the use of indiscriminate violence in African conflicts, and also the response to those conflicts by the African Union and other regional blocs. He's also got a number of other positions. He's a visiting senior research fellow at the Centre for Conflict and Health at King's College London, and a visiting researcher at the Peace Research Institute of Oslo, and a fellow at the Michael Nicholson Centre for Conflict and Cooperation. So quite a few hats that you wear. We also have here is Peter Albrecht, who's a senior researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies and the author of several books on Sierra Leone. His expertise is in the field of security, peace and development, both in terms of policy and in terms of offering programmatic approaches to reforming the security intelligence services, as well as the judiciary and other sectors. And apart from Sierra Leone, where he spent many years, his work focuses on Ghana, Somalia and Kenya. And then at the end is Oliver Major, who's the Chief of General Staff's visiting fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, also here in London, where he helps develop thinking on the future development of the army. And because he works in an independent environment, he can come up with a few more sort of challenge the status quo, as it were. And he's served in Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Kosovo and Afghanistan, as well as on civil contingencies operations here in the UK. He's also worked on intelligence focused on Africa, and he's chaired NATO's Land Operations Working Group and their Land Doctrine Panel. All the views that he's going to express this evening are his, and they're not those of the Army or the MOD or of RUSI. And then finally, we have Megan Peterson, who's the Remote Warfare Programme's Research and Policy Officer, and she's the other person who wrote this report. Her work concentrates on the West's shift towards remote warfare, and she supports the remote warfare programme's engagement with Parliament, political parties and policymakers. She's co-authored a hard-hitting report on the transparency and accountability of special forces in remote warfare. And you can find her work in places such as Small Wars Journal, Defence One and Open Democracy. So a great panel here, and we're going to start off with the co-authors of the report, who are going to lay out its key findings and the recommendations that, for improvements as well.
Thank you, and thank you very much, everyone, for coming. There are a few more seats here, if anyone's tired. Do feel free to sit down. So, thank you so much for coming, and I really look forward to discussing the report with you both tonight and over the next few months when you've actually had time to read it. So, first, given that remote warfare and fusion doctrine are two terms that are going to come up a lot tonight, during tonight's discussion, well, first Megan will outline what they mean, which sounds like it'll be useful, and then I will go in and explain our research and the five-step approach we suggest for improving UK foreign policy in Africa.
Again, thank you very much all for coming. So I'm going to address two key terms. The first one is remote warfare, and then go on to fusion doctrine. So as Mary said, remote warfare is a shift that we've seen since Iraq and Afghanistan, and the cost of military interventions there, in which states like the UK are increasingly hesitant to deploy a large amount of their own troops, and instead they focus on supporting local and regional forces through support such as intelligence, air support, training and equipment, and sometimes with forces as well. So that's a very basic introduction to warfare. We have a whole series in the back, we can learn more about that. And in regards to fusion doctrine, as many of you will know, that was a concept that was introduced in the 2018 National Security Capabilities Review, which promised the fusion doctrine would strengthen our collective approach to national security. It's supposed to build on and enhance previous efforts to do the same coordination of UK departments to respond to crises abroad. In some ways, we've already seen quite tangible effects from the fusion doctrine. For example, we've seen the senior responsible officer position has been created to make one individual accountable for each National Security Council objective and ensure there's collaboration between different departments in the delivery of those objectives. However, in spite of the impressive progress we've seen already, there are enduring challenges that remain. So first of all, while fusion doctrine has proven its ability to mobilize in times of crisis, there's still a gap when it comes to creating routine fusion when the threats are pronounced, and there's no direct threat to national security. Secondly, most of the current efforts to fuse UK activities could focus quite strongly on bringing together UK officials. However, it appears to have a lasting effect of fusion doctrine. It has to bring team engagement with a much wider group of stakeholders, including other international actors, the host government, and civil society, both in the UK and abroad. This is particularly important as more and more military operations around the world are conducted through remote warfare, in which these challenges become quite evident. In these places, the UK is really the largest or the most committed actor. This light footprint means that it has to have a lasting impact. It has to engage with and coordinate with other actors on the ground.
Thank you. So the Sahel and the Horn of Africa are congested spaces, as Mary said, for remote warfare, with numerous actors carrying out small-scale, poorly coordinated operations, which often risk undermining regional stability. The UK has sought to address some of these problems, and in August 2018, then Prime Minister Theresa May visited South Africa, Nigeria, and Kenya, and while there, she presented the UK's new Africa strategy. The UK military also has an important role to play in this, and in particular, it seems that military training partnerships will remain a key part of the UK's approach. To understand what these changes mean, particularly drawing on what Megan just said, we conducted field research in Kenya and Mali and interviewed British and international soldiers, and interviewed British soldiers coming back from Somalia and Nigeria. Alongside this, we conducted a series of interviews and closed-door roundtables with British and international experts from academia, the government, the military, civil society, both in the UK and in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel. We were there. We interviewed them over the phone. And this research showed that while there's been impressive improvements in the UK's approach, there's a number of enduring challenges and also opportunities that are presented by fusion doctrine. to improve the UK's approach and also to deliver for our partners in Africa and for global peace and stability more generally. So to exploit these opportunities and address these challenges, we suggest a five-step approach to making fusion doctrine work. We would be delighted to go into every single one of these, which makes up the 40-page report. But in the interest of keeping to our own time limit, I'll just briefly lay out what they are, and then hopefully we can discuss them in more detail either tonight or as we engage in developing more in the future. So the first looks at whole of government thinking in wide work. We argue that progress in this area has been strong, but there remains problems in bridging the different languages, cultures, and planning processes across departments. Second, we look at the implementation of this approach between UK personnel and country. We argue that despite improvements to empowering UK personnel on the ground, enduring problems with the feedback loop between those making strategy in Whitehall and those operating in the ground create a key barrier to effective fusion in country. Third, we look at the coordination of UK and other international actors engaging in the same space. Here, we argue that the UK's more forward-facing, internationally focused Global Britain agenda is positive, but efforts to coordinate international efforts are often undermined by the UK prioritising national objectives, influence and reputation over uniting international efforts and building long-term stability. Fourth, we look at establishing a meaningful dialogue with the host country. The UK has acknowledged the importance of speaking to a host country to find out the real needs meeting our partners. Yet, this is often undermined by the UK presenting its strategy too late in the process and focusing on tactical training, which are never going to address underlying political problems. Fifth, we look at creating a meaningful dialogue between UK Parliament and civil society, both in the UK and the countries in which the UK is engaged in. Here, we argue that while the UK has acknowledged the need for this meaningful conversation to improve UK strategy, the level of engagement can be variable and often insufficient.
At the end of each of these steps, we have a case study of where UK and US partners have gone a really good way to achieve some of these goals. So for instance, we examined why the UK's approach is really almost so effective, something which Peter will look at later. We also looked at how the Belgian Special Forces effectively focused on building its national coherence in this year, rather than focusing on their own national interests. And finally, we examined how our own colleagues at the ORG Strategic Peacebuilding Programme, who are all in the back, have worked to project and advance concerns and aims of civil society groups in Yemen and elsewhere. And feel free to ask them questions as you know the examples.
And then at the end of the report, we outline some policy recommendations aimed at making these successes systematic in UK engagement. These include things like creating a senior responsible officer who can coordinate activity at the country level to complement the one at the NSC level, and suggesting ways to institutionalise engagement with external experts. We hope that in doing so, we can advance the conversation in how to implement fusion and make it effective and useful so the UK can achieve its objectives, improve its offer to its partners in Africa and elsewhere, and advance global peace and security. So I'm glad you're all here, and we have this amazing expert panel who can unpick some of these questions, issues, and opportunities in more detail.
Thank you very, very much, Abigail and Megan. That was a fantastic summary of your report, and also setting out your recommendations, which seem to make a lot of sense. And we're now going to hear from Andrew from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, who I believe is going to look at the responses of the UK and its allies to conflicts in Africa and whether they're actually addressing the root causes of these conflicts. And I believe, are you going to be focusing on South Sudan?
In and out.
Okay, wonderful. Okay,
so I just want to say thank you to Abigail and Megan for this wonderful report as well. What it does, I think it gives, and there's six, I think, real important points here or takeaways from this report. The first is that it allows the UK government to rethink why the fusion model is not working but effectively reposition itself to be more useful in the long run. And I think that's crucial. It's not just about implementing the policy, but it's focusing on where we're going wrong, what we need to do, and how we can improve that. Secondly, it highlights the issue of a strategy which I think is solely focused on remote militarized security. So this sort of distance approach on how we do security, how we do sort of military approach to conflict resolution, conflict mitigation, which doesn't encapsulate the whole entire picture, and oftentimes the picture that is taking place on the ground. And actually, what it does do is highlight the potential for increased use of human rights violations, particularly against individual civilians, but collective civilians on the ground as well. This security lens, and oftentimes the security lens in which this approach has been taken, reinforces many regimes. So if you look at the regimes in South Sudan, and I am saying the regime because it has been there for several years, and Rwanda and Uganda, it reinforces the way in which they use not only violence, but also how they control state and society. And I think that's important because it highlights that in this report. Not the examples, but the way in which it can long-term do that. I think the fourth area, which I think this report does really well, is to look at the way in which the UK is placed when it comes to, I would say, a third-party actor. So if you think about the space in which it's operating in, there's France, there's the US, there's China, there's Russia, there's Japan, and all of the Middle Eastern countries, as you've rightly pointed out. But it shows that in order for the UK to do well, it needs to really think through how it's going to do it, or risk doing more harm than it's worth. So that's something that the report really does. It also, I think, supports the need for sort of the relations that the UK tries to approach, or how it tries to approach things, from maybe a bilateral perspective, in the sense of its relationship with France in the Sahel, trying to support in the long run to maybe get favorable concessions later on, isn't really the approach that it should be taking as well. And I think the final thing is, which for me was one of the things after reading the second time around yesterday, was that for fusion to be effective, it requires the UK to either take the French approach, which is to really be in the African continent for several decades, or the Chinese model, which is what you're seeing currently. So what are the sort of responses that I, takeaways that I take from this, and the things that I think that the UK should be learning from? I think there needs to be an ability to separate the political agenda of Whitehall from the realities on the ground. So really asking the question, why is the UK there? Why is it important? And what is the relevance beyond the 2 to 3 year funding gap? And oftentimes, you know, a lot of the programs that are done on the ground are 2 to 3 years, oftentimes 4 years, but it needs to think long term. What is the aims, and what are we trying to get? What we're trying to get out of it? And is there a need for us to be there? And if not, then why are we there? Because if not, you're just doing more harm in the long run. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. We talked about conflict drivers, or something that I'm always looking at. It's very good. I was based in South Sudan for a few years, and it's very good to send troops to Bentu and Malaka, which is the Upper Nile regions of South Sudan. But if you're not dealing with the drivers, the triggers, and the intervening factors of conflict, then troops who build hospitals, and not only work otherwise, but build hospitals or see women through to where they go to farm in the day, doesn't support the long-term growth of the country. And actually, what it does, I would say, if anything, it misaligns the country. Because if you're focused purely on, for example, building hospitals, when the situation is about to blow up, then what you've done is provide a shelter for armed groups and rebel groups to hide amongst these various places that you've built. So actually, there should be more of a focus, I would say, at this moment in time, on DDR programs. How do you, particularly the R, reintegrating troops? How do you go about supporting them? How do you reform, as it were, the SPLA, which is the army, from the movement? And how do you separate the two? But also, how do you create an army that is disciplined, that respects human rights, but above all, is willing to put the people forward first, which is really, I think, something that we need to think about again. I think the third aspect, which for me is something which hasn't really been talked about, is Africa should not be used as a testing ground for a lot of these sort of grand theories. really they should be thought through. The right analysis should be done. It should have all aspects as part of it, not just good data analysis, but also good assessments and also realistic outcomes. What are the outcomes that you hope to achieve? Not just sort of enrolling out theories that really don't really work on the ground, but actually because someone in Whitehall said, actually, this is a good agenda and we should push forward for that. The fifth point I would like to make is, I think fusion should really include early warning, early response mechanisms. And it should, if you look at what's going on in, particularly in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, we see that obviously there's a coalition of Western partners who are trying to deal with piracy, but we're neglecting the Gulf of Guinea and the issues that are taking place there. So fusion should be really about early warning. How do we respond to things at an early point? How do we deal with this? We also, which is my sixth point, is that we should be mindful of fusion through the French. I know there's some French people in the audience, and the reason why I say this is because we have ECOWAS in the region, who in the Sahel region, who is the regional economic community or body that is undermined by the G5 Sahel operations. And what the UK is doing is actually aligning itself with French and undermining the regional body. Now, none of us would stand here and allow, let's say, if we were, the UAE and other countries to take up or undermine NATO, for example. We would never allow that. So why are we doing the same thing? Why aren't we using existing mechanisms and bodies there to help move things forward? And I think that's really important. Taking that into consideration, I think the UK should work more with the regional partners, particularly, as I said, ECOWAS, the African Union, SADC, IGAD as well. Because if they don't, what you have is a misalignment. And you see that in South Sudan currently, where the UK or troubled countries, UK, US and Norway, were calling for the peace agreement to happen on the 12th of November. And then 2 days before, IGAD says, actually, we're going to extend it for 100 days. So this misalignment means that we're not in line or in tune with what's going on the ground as well. The eighth point, and is the UK is involved in a mission with France, as I said earlier, where a growing number of civilians have seen a rise of civilian deaths. And so what it will do in the long run is, if it continues, is it associates the death rate for people on the ground to the UK. So even though France is leading the way, people on the ground would then say, well, actually, since the French have been here, and I've just come back from Senegal, everyone is screaming out saying, well, the French are here, the numbers have gone up, what's going on? And it links the UK to that association, and we have to be mindful of that as well in the long run. And then sort of the ninth point, which is my last closing point, as we have an overcrowded competing space, I think what is important is that we're given, if we're not careful, authoritarian leaders options. And options in the long run contribute to declining local, traditional, and civil society organization positions. So what it does is, it leaders, particularly if you see in Mali, particularly in South Sudan, what they don't do is take responsibility for their actions or lead the way to resolve things, because actually they're saying, well, the international partners do it. Why do we have to worry about that? So we have to be mindful, but also how it undermines the local mechanisms that exist when it comes to traditional ways of doing things, whether it be the local chiefs and how they might gather certain people to resolve conflicts and issues. And all of those things undermine that. So I think it's really important that we look at that as well. And
thank you very much, Andrew, for that list of very strong points you've made, and a lot to think about there. And now we're going to hear from Peter from the Danish Institute for International Studies.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you also to Megan and Abigail for the invitation. I also read the report with great interest, and I think it is interesting that we're still talking about coordination wherever we are, because it is true, as Mary said, in the 1990s, when Blair came to power, this was also a big discussion about how to do better coordination across Whitehall, how to get FCO, DFID, and MOD to actually work together better, and also abroad, how they could pull together funding in the now infamous African and Global Conflict Prevention Pools, and work better together in the world and in conflicts. The 1990s obviously are very, 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 very different contexts to talk about, And what I'm going to do a little bit here is, in my very short time, I'm not used to only speak 7 minutes, but maybe now I will speak 5 because I'm trying to time it really well. but talk a little bit about Sierra Leone in the 1990s. There was a war, there was a civil war during the 1990s, actually, and the UK played a huge role in ending the conflict, but also actually supporting Sierra Leone in trying to get out of conflict and out of sort of dealing with the roots of the conflict, and then compare a little bit with Somalia. So I've spent a lot of time in Sierra Leone working. So as Mary said, I wrote a few books about Sierra Leone and did my PhD there. I worked there as a consultant. I also, for a couple of years, worked in Somalia, both in Mogadishu and in Puntland. And it felt really like coming from Sierra Leone to East Africa, first Nairobi and then Somalia, it really felt like coming from the small village to the big city, because the drama that is playing out in East Africa is so substantial, so fundamental compared to Sierra Leone. That was really, it's a small country. It was a much smaller dynamic, you could say. I wouldn't say conflict, but a smaller dynamic to step into. Okay, so I have 3 points that I will try to make. I will not be as structured as Andrew, I can guarantee that. But when the UK went into Sierra Leone, in very short, they were the only really big country that actually entered Sierra Leone. There was a special relationship between Sierra Leone and the UK due to a colonial past. There was an invitation from then President Kabat for the UK to enter Sierra Leone and support the government. So you could say that actually that special relationship really played out politically in Sierra Leone. This is very, very different from Somalia, obviously. As Mary said, there are many players in Somalia. It is basically, you could say, sort of the transition between Africa and the Middle East, Somalia. And therefore, the Middle East, first of all, has very great interest in Somalia. Turkey has great interest, as was just mentioned. They play basically the role that China plays in many other parts of the continent, putting up roads, putting up lights, building the airport, which I think in many parts of Africa, you go to Ethiopia, you go to many parts of many countries, you will see Chinese airports, and in Somalia it's Turkey. And then you have, of course, the Americans playing a big role as well, having special forces, training Puntland forces, for instance, which is the northern region in Somalia, in fighting terrorists. And this is not necessarily coordinated with Mogadishu. So my point with that is that there are a lot of different actors and players in Somalia, and they are all playing to a national agenda. And then, of course, as Mary also said, Ethiopia and Kenya. Ethiopia has a historical presence in Somalia. It's not something that has happened within the last few years. There's been a war between the two countries in 1979, and that has really also meant that Ethiopia is really present in Somalia. Kenya much more reluctantly, but also has a lot of interest in Somalia. The point here is that there is a dramatic sort of presence of the international community in Somalia, which obviously makes it very difficult to also coordinate, and especially for the UK to play sort of a strong role in coordinating what happens within Somalia. This was very different in Sierra Leone in the 1990s. As I indicated, there was a special relationship between Sierra Leone and the UK. Indicative of that is that the government invited Keith Biddle, a British police officer, to become the Inspector General of Police, who has an executive mandate in Sierra Leone to be the chief of the police. He also tried cover to get Dave Richards to become the chief of defense staff, but I think that both Claire Short and, the UK government and also Dave Richards felt that was a little bit too sort of neo-colonial, which we could probably agree with. For him to do so, that was not but it shows, first of all, sort of the complete lack of faith in a military in Sierra Leone that had done made two coups during the 1990s, and really no faith in his own people, basically, in the security sector. The UK was also, so you had DFID as well, playing a really big role in the security sector at this time, supporting the Office of National Security, ensuring national security coordination was taking place within Sierra Leone. Also an invitation to sit really at the heart of the government. There were advisors in the Ministry of Defence, there were advisors that were setting up an intelligence service. We had, there was a big program in support of the police, so you could just, sorry, my computer just died. So you could really just say that compared to Somalia, where the UK is able to play a much smaller role today, in Sierra Leone at this point in time, there was really sort of a very strong presence of the UK. And it also meant, of course, that coordination was easier. Did not mean that it wasn't turf. There weren't turf wars between the different departments, as we also have seen more currently. For instance, that DFID has all the money, FCO is trying to lead, and the MOD is running after FCO. But in fact, DFID does not want to listen to what the political lead is saying in the country, and there you have the turf war between who's actually deciding and calling the shots in Sierra Leone, also in the 1990s. And I find it very interesting in the report to talk about a coordination mechanism in country. And we had the same conversation when we wrote a book in 2005 about how a recommendation could be to actually have somebody in country who would oversee these three departments in country. But who would that be? And who would accept this fourth sort of agency or department coming in and telling these three other departments that they know how to do things. So I think another thing that really differentiates Sierra Leone and Somalia is that it happened, Sierra Leone obviously happened before 9/11, just a few years before 9/11, so the military intervention happened in 2000, but the whole sort of setup of British presence in Sierra Leone together with the Sierra Leone government happened prior to 9/11, which is also a big difference in comparison to Somalia, obviously. I don't think you can underestimate how much there was this idea that the liberal democratic way of doing things had won in the 1990s. So there was this really strong idea, also in UN peacekeeping, that you could go in and make states into liberal democracies, and that the democratic ways of doing things had won over military ways of doing things. So it meant that when 1997, when Blair set up his government, DFID was also established, obviously, with that government, and it was a very strong department. It had a much clearer, visionary idea about how to sort of set a path for UK sort of presence in the world, and the military Minister of Defence were really, to a much larger extent, looking for a role in the post-Cold War world. So Clare Short, who was the first minister, and then quite a visionary minister, and also sort of building a power base in Paddy Street, where DFID was at the time, was really sort of setting the path for sort of UK presence. And I had presence abroad, and I had a conversation with her about her time about Sierra Leone, and there was this. She sort of talked about intelligence, the different agencies coming to her and saying, hey, we have some good ideas for how you can use us. And she was like, no, I don't want that. Now we have, the world has changed. It's not a Cold War world that we're living anymore. So it was a completely different way of looking at the world. And I think that's very important in terms of how she felt that she could also play a strong role in Sierra Leone, and how much aligned the three departments were at the time before Iraq and Afghanistan happened. Obviously, Somalia is a very different scenario, and it's much more sort of in line with the Cold War war on terror sort of dynamic. So I think I'm running out of time, but
one or two more minutes.
Okay, sure. So I think the third point to keep in mind is also how, in terms of coordination, is how much of a political project Sierra Leone became in the 1990s. It was at the heart of government at the time. It was the only place in Africa where the UK wanted to play a role. There were a lot of stories about why Tony Blair wanted to go into Sierra Leone. It was because his, the first black person he saw was a Sierra Leonean, or his dad worked there as a teacher. So there were a lot of these stories running around, but and this was Claire Short actually who told me this, but the bottom line was that Sierra Leone was the only place where in Africa where the UK government in Blair's first period actually did a major intervention like this. Claire Short looked at Sierra Leone as well, and for humanitarian reasons, she was also animated by what she saw. People were being maimed. The conflict was seen as sort of a symbol of what the world, what conflicts, internal conflicts, would look like in the post-Cold War world. And so she was also animated. And then there was the Tim Spicer crisis. That's not the right word. But anyway, when Tim Spicer sold weapons to Sierra Leone, and their CEO in Sierra Leone was involved in it. It was a big scandal. That was the word. A big scandal. And Robin Cook was adamant and told this to David Richard that this could not happen again. We could not have a similar sort of like crisis, a sort of embarrassment for the UK, which would also be if Sierra Leone fell completely apart. So there were a lot of different sort of very central figures in the UK government at the time who were very interested in doing something in Sierra Leone. And obviously, as I want to point out, in the beginning, coordination is political. It's about the fight for resources. And if the highest level of politics is involved in actually defining what the departments are going to do, then obviously there's going to be much more impetus to do it. And I won't say any more until I'm asked.
Thank you very, very much. And finally, before we open it up to the floor, Oliver, it would be great to hear from you as the Chief of Staff, visiting fellow Risi.
Thank you.
But not representing either of them, representing ourselves.
So, I mean, it's a huge privilege to be here with a slightly daunting academic panel to my left. I did ask Kevin Jack Watling, who's the landlord for fellow at Risi, for advice on doing this. And he said, well, you might not be able to add significantly to the academic debate, but what you will be able to do is speak in within your time limits and make sure you don't go on too long. And I'm going to try and do that. Although I noticed that actually we're well on time. So I think the first thing to say about fusion doctrine from a military perspective is that it ties in entirely with the way the military thinks about itself. So soldiers are taught, soldiers, sailors, airmen and marines are taught to go out there and achieve what they can within a stated aim, within the constraints that are given to them. And I was struck by a line in the report, or a number of lines in the report, and a number of comments from people who were interviewed, that one of the problems in the past has been that the military tends to pick up the problem and go and run at it and get ahead of everybody else. The great thing about fusion doctrine is that it provides the riding instructions and the context to make the military slow down and play in time with everybody else. And that's really, really important, because as an organisation, the military seeks to be proactive and is, you know, is right for us to do that. And that, again, I think comes out really well in the report. But it's really important, and this goes right the way back to Clausewitz, that military activity is supporting political aims, policy aims. And the discussion and the debate between the Foreign Office and DFID and the military about ways and means of achieving policy aims is really important. It should be choppy, it should be difficult in the MOD and in the Foreign Office, and those discussions should be difficult. But I'm reassured talking around Whitehall to colleagues and people that actually what it seems to be doing is putting us on a better footing as a group, as an organisation, as a government, to deliver the right ends in the right ways and balance those activities well. And one symptom of that, I think, is the comment in the report and a repeating comment that came out about soldiers on the ground who, you know, there's more we could do. And of course that's true, because the military will never run out of ways it can do things. We might run out of resources, but we'll never run out of enthusiasm. The The challenge, therefore, is for the military to continue to provide proactive options which can be refereed by the policy end state and alignment with the main policy. And I think that's really useful. And I think that's where the cross-Whitehall dialogue comes in. I was particularly, and I continue to be particularly impressed with the work of the British Peace Support Team in Africa, which is referenced in the report, and, you know, was a source of, I think, of, you know, some of the discussion, which has a very, very, very positive role in managing this. And what it does, of course, is manage the aspirations of those MOD representatives placed in the embassies, the defence attachés, who can provide their country theme and then have a mechanism through the British Peace Support Team for their activity to be checked against the plans and against the objectives and against the focuses. And I sense that this is a positive development for the MOD because it allows us to ensure that our activity is properly aligned to that which government wants to achieve, and that is really useful. It also talks to a point that Andrew brought up, which is the relationship between conditionality and risk and the desire to help at the lowest level, which I think is something that is really important. What I mean by that is making sure that we do the right things in the right ways to support the right outcomes again in the country based on what we're trying to achieve. And it's that balance of local understanding that defence attachés, when they're doing their job, well, and they increasingly are a highly professional group of people, they always were, who can bring the local engagement, bring the discussions with admittedly local regimes because it's militaries, can reconcile that with their ambassadors and with the rest of the embassy team, and then present it to the military for the allocation of military resources. And I think if we can continue to get that balance right, then the engagement in a fused approach to delivering the military line of a cross-governmental approach to security in difficult areas will improve. I mean, I think there are other things that are interesting. I think, for example, there are always challenges with putting military people into multinational missions and then seeking to engage them and leverage them, because once they're in that mission, their job is to support that mission. And actually, the policy way is that we want that mission to succeed. So we have to be really careful about not compromising the integrity of the task we have asked people to do. But a properly fused approach and full engagement across Whitehall is absolutely, I think, in line with the way the military wants to see itself and wants to conduct itself, and can only continue to be positive if we get it right. But it is cross-Whitehall activity, and the military is only one line in that activity.
Thank you very much, and thank you all of you for keeping to time so well. That was really impressive, so thank you very much. Before opening it up to the floor, there's something that's been sort of started to puzzle me after listening to all of you, actually, is that you talk about how important it is for different government departments to be joined up, and also how important it is for the UK to be joined up with other foreign actors. And then you also talk about the importance of speaking to local people and civil society organisations and all of that. But how can you really be sure that last bit, because I must say, through my work, I've reported on Africa for the past 25 years, and in places like Somalia, that seems to be the thing that, even though people pay lip service to it, it's missing, and they don't engage, and they don't go and talk to people on the ground and see really what they think about what might work. And do you think there's any kind of genuine commitment to actually engaging the local communities, not just the national governments and militaries?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an enduring problem, which is why it's the last chapter of the report. But one of the things that we often saw was that even when civil society groups were engaged, it became a tick box exercise, so we can say we engage with civil society. And I think one of the things from our point of view, and Megan, feel free to jump in, is when it comes to remote warfare, and the UK footprint is small, and it's often not the most committed or the most well-developed presence in the country, and it doesn't plan to stay there for a long time.
one of the first things that we lose is that political engagement, that willingness to have a long-term engagement with civil society to make sure that engagements can deliver for both the people in the country as well as all the international actors and the government. And that was why we were so keen to emphasise the work of our, the other programme at the Oxford Research Group, because they work to magnify the voices of local people to ensure that they can't be ignored, because I think there's in the budget cuts and an attempt to get a decision, they're often the first thing to go, because that's the hardest thing, but it's often the most important. I don't know if anyone else wants to.
And I think as well, like, civil society is kind of a very good tool when it comes to kind of to measuring the population's approach to what's happening on the ground. And like Henry, like you were saying before, how it's a hell, especially there's so much, I think, growing mistrust among many populations of the Western interventions. And so having that measurement of how the civilians on the ground should think of it is very important for designing future programs. It's definitely a priority.
The only thing I was going to say is, so one of the things I think engaging with civil society is really important. One of the things that I'm always mindful of, and having worked in Nepal for a few years before I worked in South Sudan, was that oftentimes, particularly the UN or certain organizations, would work with the same civil society groups, and it would perpetuate the same sort of, or recreate elite systems within the same existing system, and then you have another problem, and then to the parties leave. So I think it's engaging with civil society is important, but also diversifying. I think, and it's that long term. I know I'm hammering on the long term focus, but really thinking, okay, who are the groups? Who do we want to engage with? How do we uplift certain groups? So, for example, the Dalit groups in Nepal, the low class, it took them the best part of almost 15 years for them to even be present in the national political arena. But how do we go about doing that from the start? How do we really empower these groups long term, and not just think, okay, civil society, who can we get? Okay, we get a group of these people and we put them together. And they're in every meeting, in every group, again and again. That doesn't help the situation.
Yeah. I would also agree with what Andrew said, but also say that civil society is not always a population. I mean, there's a professionalization of civil society that means that you're actually working with groups that know how to speak a language that donors understand, that they appreciate, and that they will pay for. So it's there's also that aspect of it, and I think most international organizations and bilateral donors and multilateral, they want to engage, they want to work with the people that, you know, that the traditional leaders, the chiefs, the secret societies, but they do not have access to these institutions necessarily, and they don't know how to actually program around them so that they're actually engaged in the processes that they want them to engage in. Another thing is that often governments do not want donors to go directly to civil society because they want money and funding to be channeled through them. So they decide on who's being funded and how they're being funded. And it happened in Sierra Leone because at one point they were trying to do a program and it was a time when non-state actors was really high on the agenda. And the people that did the program were really quite sort of like, you know, they tried to be innovative, they tried to really channel most of the money into local communities. And the government sent them a letter saying, this is not what we want, and we don't want you to undermine us before we actually have functioning government. And they had to recalibrate the program. The last thing I will say is that in Somalia, access is a problem. I think DFID, I've done some work for DFID in Somalia, they engage national civil society organizations, and I think they want to do that. But they hardly have access to Mogadishu, and then they hire somebody like me who's sort of, you know, if I die, it's not as bad as someone of their own to die. And so we are allowed to go out and talk to people, travel around to Baidoa, to Kismayo, and talk to people, but it's tricky. It's difficult when you don't have access, you only see 5% of actually what's going on, and the 50% of the 5% that you see is what they want you to see, because they also in the business of development. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you want to add anything?
I think all I would say is that, you know, if you read British military doctrine, it tells you that one of the things militaries can do is provide access to difficult areas where security is hard. But there's a balance to be struck, because militaries, whether we like it or not, represent or are associated, as Andrew said, with governments. And so whilst, you know, it is important that we can facilitate that access where it's right, that's fundamentally how you want to achieve that access is a decision for FCO representatives, different representatives, about whether it meets their ends or not. And it just brings us back, I think, to this conversation, the constant conversation about what is the right way for the military to behave in these circumstances. Are we being helpful in the way we're doing things? Are we not being helpful? And again, just making sure that when we act, it's the right things to do, because it will happen quite quickly in some circumstances. But you've got to be really careful that that's the thing you want to have.
Thank you very much.